Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, exploring the cultures of conversation about consciousness. I had to have three C's in there today. Speaking of C's, I recently participated in three C's, in fact, a very interesting conversation on minds.com, a site worth checking out. And the conversation was entitled Complexity, Culture, and Consciousness. So you got those C's are sprouting up everywhere. And it was a wonderful conversation, interesting mode. We were all on, you know, Google Chat, and we could see each other's faces, and people were checking it out, and I had never really done a kind of online multiple-person conversation in that format before, and it was actually very interesting. It was definitely a new way of staging conversation around big topics and jumping around for sure, but somehow a kind of interesting neural network developed. There a number of the people on the conversation were people who have been on Expanding Mind. We had Richard Doyle and Michael Garfield, and it was hosted by Bill Ottman, a very interesting character. But the person I didn't know about, who I was most happy to meet, was Neil Thies, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name right.
Thies.
Thies?
It's a Thies.
Thies, okay.
In America.
There
yeah.
we go. and he, very interesting talk and some articles I read by him before the conversation, and I was very struck with the way that he approached these issues. He has a great talk on Vimeo called Complexity Theory and Panpsychism, and that's a lot of what we'll be talking about today is how the ideas of complexity science, the ideas of a kind of hierarchy in the universe from the very smallest to the very largest as being a sort of hierarchy of different stages or levels of complexity, and then how that model relates to consciousness and the question of mind and where mind is, how mind happens. I think that Neil's ideas here are very clear and very persuasive. I'm quite a fan of this way of thinking about things. But then, interestingly, on top of being a science guy, he is a researcher and a stem cell specialist, and got into, and we'll be talking a little bit about that. So he does real deal research as well as thinking about complexity and consciousness. But he's also a Zen Buddhist and very interested in Kabbalah. So it really covers a lot of the bases we have here on Expanding Mind. So I'm really happy that Neil decided to join us today. Before we bring him on, we'll get our co-host on here. Maja Daou. Maja, good morning.
Good morning.
How's life been for you lately? Has it been complex?
I usually go in and out of waves of that, but yeah, that's funny. I think of The Guide to the Perplexed by Moses Maimonides when you asked me that. But no, I read and think about panpsychism a lot. So, and of course, complexity, right? Because I'm one of those people that follows the whole universe as a hologram type of situation and all the fractal stuff. So I love everything about everything we're going to be talking about today, because it's all things that I spend a good deal of time thinking about. And of course, you know, for my work, I try to find people's patterns. So I literally, I feel like a little bit like a scientist. I'll look at people and try to find their complex patterns, much like people do in microbial research or astronomical research. But I do it with people.
Wonderful. Well, let's bring Neil onto the show. Neil, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for asking me to join in.
Yeah. So I thought it might be interesting to start out with how your research in stem cells, and you're also a liver pathologist, so you got to deal with all sorts of ornery cells, and how your research with this stuff, very, you know, important medical questions, leads to these larger issues in your own mind about complexity And, you know, and then we can get to consciousness later, but complexity will be a good place to start.
Sure. You know, it's as a liver pathologist, which means that, let's say someone gets a liver biopsy because they've got chronic hepatitis C, for example. I'm the person who looks at it under the microscope and says, yes, it is hepatitis C, and they have this much scarring, which helps figure out whether they should have treatment or not, for example. Or if there's a liver tumor, I'm the one who identifies under the scope what kind of tumor it is. Is it a tumor? So, and my clinical practice is really looking at human tissues. And while I do research in that area, it's what we call clinical pathologic correlation. So for the most part, it's been, you know, see diseases, see how they show up in the biopsies, correlate that with clinical information, keep an eye out for new diseases or changing patterns of disease, things like that. But because I sort of have the privilege, and I feel that way, to look at human tissues under the scope, and I was working with the liver transplant team. Now I'm at Mount Sinai Beth Israel Hospital in New York, but back then I was at New York University Hospital Medical Center. And it gave me a clue, what I was seeing under the microscope in the clinical specimens, as to where that there were, in fact, stem cells in the liver. And today, people think, oh, everything has stem cells. But just 15 years ago, really only the blood, the skin, and the GI tract were convincingly thought to have stem cells. The brain did not. The heart did not. Maybe the liver did, but the vast majority of people where the liver was concerned didn't think so. But I was seeing them under the microscope. And so it was my group that first established in human livers that, in fact, the liver had stem cells and what they look like, how to find them. And kind of under pressure from my chairman, I applied for grant money to go study this and went off on sabbatical. And that got me into the stem cell stuff, which was kind of a surprise. And what I had found in the liver kind of explained almost all of the liver manifestations that were seen, except for a couple of animal experiments, which suggested that my ideas of where the stem cells were, which are in the tiniest bile ducts, like who cares about bile ducts, right? But it turns out that's where the stem cells hang out. Maybe they were coming from elsewhere, and that led me to looking into the bone marrow as a source, and it was my group of researchers, primarily with Diane Krause at Yale, and a bunch of other teams that were starting to have similar ideas at the same time. Starting in like 1999, the work started getting published, to 2001 when we published our single cell, adult cell, stem cell experiment that showed that adult cells could really do anything human cells could do, embryonic stem cells could do, rather.
Right. And so then the question becomes, what are these cells doing there? How can we think about the system of cells and all the well-defined adult cells that are doing their appointed tasks, and then running around are these curious little bits of potential cell? And so this becomes this, it ends up being a somewhat larger question then, where you have to start thinking about systems.
Right, and I had not yet started thinking about systems. I was really thinking about just classical cell biology, tissue biology sort of stuff. And then I got lucky. A friend of mine who was in the UK put me together with an artist named Jane Proffitt, and we got a grant from the Wellcome Trust in the UK where they're interested in interdisciplinary conversations. And so they wanted to have an artist and a scientist hang out together and teach each other what they do and record the conversations. So they actually paid for me to go to London and for her to come here to New York. And I was telling her about some of the controversies in the stem cell field that, we were finding that cells, let's say, from the bone marrow could go to the liver and become liver, or go to the GI tract, go to the skin. But it was often, without any severe injury, very low level, just like 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000. And that some people were dismissing this as trivial. And she said, well, that sounds like the couple of percent of ants that aren't following the food line in an ant colony. And I said, how do you figure? And she said, well, it's complexity theory. It's a complex system. And her artwork had been looking at how people interact with virtual complex systems, something called Technosphere, which was a very big deal about 15 years ago. And so she introduced me to complexity theory. And we started realizing that, yes, cells in the body and are sort of like ants in an ant colony and people in a city. And we started unpacking cells as a complex adaptive system. And so that's how I got introduced to that. And then that sort of led, and we wrote a series of papers. We expanded the team, did some cell modeling, some artificial life programming. And that led to me thinking, well, hold on a second. So let's say you have a flock of birds, and that looks like kind of a thing from a distance. And but if you go up close, you realize, oh, it's not a thing. It's just a bunch of birds. But now we're saying that bodies are made of cells that are self-organizing in the same kind of way. So if you go up to the bird at the microscopic level, there's no bird there either, like there is no flock when you get close enough. It's actually just a bunch of individual cells, both the cells of the bird and the bacteria and other one-cell species that might be necessary for the bird to be alive. The way our bodies are, you know, maybe 4 trillion human cells, you know, there are various estimates. I like this number, they're easy to remember. 4 trillion human cells and anywhere from 10 to 100 times that number of bacteria on the surface of your skin and your GI tract.
Well, I mean, that right there is sort of a good direct sense of how we are embedded in these complex systems immediately, you know, in our bodies.
Exactly.
So, 'cause I can think, well, you know, but I have a body. It's coherent. You know, it's a human body. It's got bones and stuff. It keeps its shape more or less. Yeah, I guess I can look at the tiny little cells and find, drill down until I get to a kind of quantum level. But basically, I'm in a body, and then you're like, well, yeah, come on, whose body is that? Well, how many human cells do you have in that? And suddenly you realize there's this extraordinary amount of work that's being done by these bacteria who are clearly massing and flocking and swarming and subdividing and doing this stuff all the time. It's like there's, uh-huh. I am a we. There's no way around it.
Right. And it's not as though your body could exist without them. So, for example, at the creases of your joints, like if you hold your finger up and look at the lines where your joint bends, there are specific kinds of bacteria that hang out there, and they feed on the dying skin cells at the top of the skin, and out of that they create lanolin to lubricate the joint. If you didn't have those bacteria there, the skin would break down because it's not lubricated, and you would die of infection within a few hours of birth. So without the bacteria, your body isn't your body. The GI tract, if you grow animals or humans in what's called an abiotic environment so that they don't colonize, there are no bacteria. So think the boy in the bubble. Boys who have no immune system to defend them against bacteria, they have to survive by living in an abiotic environment. They have problems digesting food because the bacteria lining the stomach, it's the interaction of the cells lining your digestive tract and the bacteria lining your digestive tract that create the microanatomy that allows for digestion. Your genes don't code for the microanatomy directly. They code for the interactions with the bacteria out of which your anatomy arises. So
a
human body isn't a human body without the bacteria.
Well, yeah, and you can take it to an even funnier level, right, and then go even more mini and say, really, all the bacteria and all the cells are also just a bunch of atoms. So it would be like claiming ownership of a carbon atom, like saying, like,
right.
Carbon atoms belong to me, whatever that is.
Yeah. Well, this is where it gets really, this is where it started to get kind of peculiar for me. the first thing was, okay, so our cells, you know, communities are not things, they're phenomena arising from bodies. And depending what kind of bodies you allow in, you can be talking about a city, an ecosystem, flocks of birds, ants, whatever. But those bodies are not things either. You go down smaller in scale and it's cells. So are they a fundamental unit, or are they arising from something smaller too? The next level down is atoms and molecules in aqueous solution. Hmm. So well, there's some weird biology stuff there that turns out, but we'll skip that for now, unless you want to come back to it. But the interesting thing is, when we say Western medicine and Western biology, what do we mean? We mean the biology and medicine that derives from the observation that bodies are made of cells, cell doctrine. And this happened, this arose as a doctrine when they first built a microscope around 400 years ago and looked at tissues under the microscope and saw cells. Now, before that experiment could be done, what the body was made of was an issue for philosophers. And going back to Greek philosophy, there was this ongoing argument as to whether the body is made of an endlessly divisible fluid continuum, or is it made up of little small subunits, which they called atoms.
Right.
And so the flow of language between physics and biology actually goes back pretty far. So when they looked under the microscope, they saw the first thing they could see were cell membranes. They didn't know how to stain tissues the way I do now as part of my daily practice. So they looked under the microscope, saw just cell walls and cell membranes, which looked like empty boxes or empty rooms. They called them cells because they looked like the cell of a monk or a prisoner with no furniture inside, just floor, ceiling, and four walls. And since you can't divide a box, an empty box, into something smaller, the argument was settled. The body is made of atoms, and we're going to call them cells because that's what they look like. My question then became, what if the technology had been different? And the first thing they saw were nuclei. It took 20 years to learn to stain tissues so they could see things like the nuclei and the Golgi apparatus inside the cells, the furniture. What if first they had seen nuclei? They would have said, oh, look, the debate is settled. We've got an endlessly divisible fluid continuum, but there's these little balls floating in it, so we'll have to figure out what those are. But then we would have had a fluid model for the body, not a cell model. And then 20 years later, they learned to look at the tissues differently, and they would have seen the cell membranes. They wouldn't have said, oh, we were wrong. They would have said, oh, look, there's semi-permeable partitioning of the fluid space. So depending on how you look at it, again, that's kind of one of the key themes here. If you pick one level of scale or another, things will look like a thing or a phenomenon. If you look at it from the point of view of cell membranes, you have cell doctrine. If you look at it from the point of view of the sub-bits of the cell, then you actually have a fluid. So I wrote this up. It's not typical for a pathologist to get published in Nature, okay, which is one of the top-tier biology journals on the planet, hard science. And but I actually managed to get a little paper in talking about the body from a complex systems point of view, and said that the notion of the body being made of cells, which defines Western medicine and Western biology, is limited to that one perspective, and that that model is necessarily incomplete because there are other perspectives. For example, a fluid model, like the Greeks talked about. And I mentioned in the paper that something like acupuncture, which is well-established, well-recognized as being a real phenomenon, that and the meridians and acupoints are important. If you cut down and dissect the tissues where the acupoints are and the meridians, there are no anatomic structures there. There are no nerves, no blood vessels, no muscle tracts. There's nothing there to distinguish it. So I said, you know, maybe a fluid model would be helpful to understand acupuncture, because if you can't explain it in terms of anatomy, you can't explain it in terms of the building blocks of anatomy, the cell. So maybe you need a different model, and I suggested a fluid model. It's just one possibility. Now, you'd think if you said that cells have no inherent existence and that the fundamental biological theory of Western life, cell doctrine, is incomplete, you'd get a response, right?
Yeah.
I would expect so.
I got two letters. I think the majority of people thought I was crazy, and then a small percentage said, yeah, that's obvious. So in either case, why write in? But one guy, both of the people who wrote to me after that were acupuncture researchers. And one of them, this guy named Edward Yang from, who's now in Hong Kong, University of Hong Kong, used to be chair of electrical engineering at Columbia. And he has retooled MRI machines so they can measure acoustic waves, sound waves, in tissue. And he wrote to me and he said, how do you know what I'm working on? I haven't published anything.
Wow. Yet.
And I said, I don't know who you are and I don't know what you're working on. And it turns out that he's been studying, and this work has been published now. This is about 5 years ago. If you take an acupuncture needle and put it in a random spot on the skin and vibrate it the way you do in therapy, you get an acoustic wave that moves out about half an inch in all directions. But if you put it on an acupoint, the sound wave travels all the way up the meridian. So the body's behaving like a fluid, and the fluid wave dynamics of the tissue seem to be relevant to what acupuncture is doing, at least
in part. Oh, that's remarkable. That totally makes sense.
Yeah, and to me, of course, the larger implication of what you're suggesting, right, this is where I would expect people's resistance is going to be, their cell wall resistance is going to meet you, because then what it's going to do is it's going to push their ability to conceive of what exactly the word life and alive and biology means, right? When you crumble the cell wall, now suddenly the distinction separating us as alive and unique from everything else begins to crumble.
Right, exactly. And that's where we start to get into the wacky world of consciousness studies. So are the molecules in aqueous solution that make your body, is that as far down as you go? Obviously not, because molecules are just atoms that are self-organizing. And what are atoms? They're subatomic particles that are self-organizing. And what are those? Smaller subatomic particles. And what are those? Well, now we're down to the smallest things. Yeah, well, strings or whatever those smallest things are. Not everyone thinks they're strings, but you know, strings or something. But there is nothing smaller. Physicists don't agree on what those things are, but they do agree that it's not an infinite regress. It's not turtles all the way down. You reach the smallest thing at the Planck length, so 10, I always forget the number, 10 to the minus 36th or 37th centimeters or meters, something like that. When I get caught with that sort of ignorance, I just go, well, look, I'm a liver pathologist. I don't really need to know.
No problem, man.
Well, but I wanted to also just say, sorry, Eric, but it's significant that all of this discovery comes from a liver pathologist. To me, if you're familiar at all with the myth of Prometheus, because it's always been remarkable that in Prometheus, the liver regenerates every day. It's his liver that's eaten. And of course, the liver is the only regenerative organ in our body, correct?
Well, now we know everything regenerates, even the brain.
Right?
But the liver is particularly dramatic. Yeah. And how the Greeks knew that, that's another question, you know. But yeah, and we are fond in our field of referring to Prometheus whenever we get the chance. So thank you for bringing it up. But where do these smallest, tiniest things come from? Well, they just pop in and out of the energy of the vacuum. The vacuum isn't truly empty. It has energy, and because energy equals mass, they're constantly turning into little matter-antimatter pairings, which usually self-annihilate, but not always. And that's the quantum foam. And so there is no place in the system where you come down to a fundamental unit that is indivisible and isn't arising from something else. And that sort of hit me. This is where it actually starts getting stirred into the Buddhist stuff, because it's hard to do any of this stem cell work if you have an imagination to not realize that when you're looking at tissues of patients or mice or whatever under the microscope, you're looking at what's going on in your own body. This is terribly self-referential. And so for the years I was doing stem cell work, I was very aware of studying myself And when Jane introduced me to complexity theory, I started to become aware of this idea of my body as a colony. I had one very vivid moment where I was, I live in Manhattan, and I was walking down 20th Street, and I came to the corner at Park Avenue, and the light changed, and I couldn't step off the curb because I was deep in contemplation of my body as colony, and I didn't really know how to move it all of a sudden. It was just a second, but it was kind of interesting.
Yeah, those self-reflexive moments can be very powerful, especially when you're hovering around the question of agency, you know, and that's what strikes me in the this question of these, you know, turtles all the way down to the quantum foam level, is it's not just that you can't find anything that's indivisible, like you could see that's an aspect of Buddhist philosophy as a kind of critical deconstruction of any kind of essence or thing or individual into its constituent parts, which themselves don't hold up to that gaze. And that's one aspect of it. But then, of course, there's also this mysterious, often marvelously undefined but very probing category of mind.
Right.
And When I heard you describe these descending levels of scale and getting down to this point of the quantum foam and what's happening there, is it's not just that everything is indivisible, but that you can't further divide it, but that when self-organization happens, when larger things, communities begin to form, they form precisely through the operation of recognizing something else that's going on, of interacting, signaling.
And then
you go, oh,
yeah.
What's that?
Yeah. And this way of looking at everything as being part of one large complex system that it interfaces with the consciousness questions to me in three ways. The first is really comes off of my exposure to the work of Francisco Varela, who is the founder of the Mind and Life Organization, that group of cognitive scientists and philosophers, etc., that meets with the Dalai Lama once a year. It's been in the news periodically. He and his mentor and collaborator, Humberto Maturana, they were from Chile. And they developed what's called autopoietic theory, which is definitely a variant of systems theory. And their initial question was, how do you define life? And they defined life operationally as systems that fulfilled certain kinds of criteria, particularly including the idea that they would create boundaries between their inside and their outside.
Huh.
And they called this autopoiesis, self-creation. And the smallest autopoietic unit is the cell. Now, they were looking at the cell, and so they derived their definition from that to some extent. But then they went
further.
Just
1 second. I'm just going to say for one moment that that actually is the telling of the story of Mary getting self-impregnated by God, right? What you just said is the exact same as the story of Jesus getting born.
Just saying, sure. I'll go with that. That works. That's the sort of thing I'm always doing, which makes a lot of my scientific colleagues a little annoyed. But I like it.
It's fun.
Yeah. But so then what they said was that it is the nature of such things to interact with each other, interact with their environment. And the way it interacts with the environment is what's happening at the cell membrane, and often that's ion channels, which is similar to the gating that goes on in neurons. And one can argue that the, let's say, calcium channels in the surface of a paramecium are actually the beginning of a nervous system, evolutionarily speaking. Now, you look at a paramecium swimming. When it encounters a barrier, it hits the barrier and then backs up. And then redirects itself until it gets around the barrier. That looks like cognitive activity, they said. So how do you define that cognitive activity? And they defined it operationally and led to the equation that if something is alive, in other words, if it's an autopoietic unit, at least a cell, if not a multicellular organism, it is by definition cognitive and to some degree conscious. And if it is not a system, and if you can demonstrate cognition, then it is by definition of life. So mind equals life, life equals mind. Where you find one, you find the other. So my question then, so this says that life happens and that in immediately, necessarily is cognitive, consciously aware in some simple fashion. Well, how that happens is that the paramecium, it hits the boundary and its cell wall flattens and the change in shape distorts the calcium channels in the cell membrane. Calcium flows out, and that calcium wave flowing out causes the flagella, the things that are stroking like oars on a Roman boat, to go from one direction to reverse direction, and so it backs up. And then the cell membrane goes back to shape, the calcium channels close, the calcium dissipates, and the oars start going back in the other direction again. So now it swims forward until it gets out the other side. So my question was, are we really incapable of identifying this kind of cognition in smaller things? Mm-hmm. And they didn't really define, and they used the term sentience in this case. And consciousness, the larger thing of consciousness, includes sentience and, you know, perceiving the world and responding to it, and sense-making. So a paramecium like sugar, it will swim up a sugar gradient. Too much acid in the water, it'll swim away. So it's sugar and acid are not good or bad, but the organism starts to make sense of it and assign value to it.
Here's my question. My question to that would be, are they able to non-define it? Can they find something that does not exhibit that behavior, right? Like, have they been able to find anything or no thing, as the case may be, that does not exhibit those behaviors in life, like, is there matter that does that?
Well, this is the sense making part I set aside because that was a little too complicated. But exactly that question, is it really a lower limit? And this, what the complexity analysis taught me is to be suspicious of lower limits. And so I first really carefully defined what I meant by sentience, what seemed to reflect what they meant. Because an air conditioner is sentient, right?
Right.
It, you know, it senses the temperature, turns on until you get to a different set point, the room cools down, and then it turns off. Do I really want to say an air conditioner is sentient? Not particularly. Right. Not in the same way a paramecium is, or that I am. What's the difference? Well, the inside of the air conditioner, the way the air conditioner operates, is completely determined. It will always do exactly the same thing. Inherent in complex systems are the few cells, the few ants that aren't following the line. What allows for adaptation in complex systems, what makes them adaptive, is the fact that there is low-level randomness. If there's no randomness, when the environment changes, you can't get a different self-organization, and the whole system will crumble. If there's too much randomness, then you don't get any self-organization because it's just disordered, like molecules in a gas. You need a little bit of randomness, so if the environment changes, the self-organization can change to be adaptive. And so this degree of randomness in the system, as well as a few other criteria, but that's the key one. Where is that in the paramecium? It's in the fact that all the calculations that take the perceived information from the environment, it's all computed inside by a complex system, the complex system of the molecules that make up the paramecium. And there's randomness in there. It's never determined. It's never going to give you precisely the same answer in a reliable way. And the output...
Well, this is the thing, though. The determiner of the randomness is the choice of the organism. Right?
I would say that it's the randomness that creates
the opening for choices.
Right.
Right.
And
right.
So defining sentience as perceiving the world, processing that information internally in a complex system fashion, and producing a response, that's sentience.
Right.
And when you make that definition, it turns out I can give you examples of molecules that do that. DNA does that. So, for example, the DNA helix is a perfect conducting wire. And so you have electrical current. The electrons of the atoms that make up the molecule are freely flowing through the double helix. But because of the structure of the base pairs, you get little eddies around the side, electron holes, where there is no flow. It turns out those are most common where you have regions of the genome that code for a specific gene, for a specific protein product. And if you have ionizing radiation that comes in that could cause a mutation, it gets trapped in that hole, and the combination gets transferred to a non-coding region where it can cause a mutation where it's not going to affect the organism.
So it almost seems like the DNA is sort of redistributing the randomness that's introduced by the potential for mutation, but redistributing it to other parts.
Yes.
Where it might cause less damage.
Exactly.
But also,
yeah,
allow something to happen.
Exactly. And so there, you have a molecule. It's not autopoietic, it's not alive by that definition, but it is cognitive. There is cognition here. A simpler form, but it's cognition. Well, what about atoms? Well, atoms are experiencing other atoms because their electron shells bump into other electron shells, so they're sensing of the outside world. And how they respond depends on the structure, the internal quantum structure of the cell. And I mean, I'm sorry, of the atom. And then a response happens where the electron shells will either bond together or not, and you have an exchange of electrons if there's going to be a bond or not. So it's similar that, like the calcium, here you've got electrons that are being exchanged, and the randomness in the system is quantum randomness, the quantum mechanical random stuff that we all hear about that makes determinists kind of go crazy. Well, how about the protons and neutrons? Same thing, except they're passing quarks back and forth. How about smaller subatomic particles? Well, now you're deep in the quantum realm, and the wave functions that describe the probabilities of where these things are, whether they're strings or something else, extend infinitely. So there is no inside and outside.
So it's really just a whole bunch of parties, and who's going to come to the party and who's not going to come to the party.
Well, and when you get down to that level, everyone's in the party.
Right. It's all one,
yeah,
big party.
Well, one of the things I love about your voyage, your intellectual, philosophical, scientific voyage here, is that you start asking these questions about what is mind or what is sentience. And you see that even these pretty robust models, like the autopoietic model of Varela and Maturana, you can talk about a lot of stuff with that model. It's very helpful. You can use it in a lot of domains of reality. But as you point out, it still claims that mind is something that emerges from a physical situation, and that there are physical situations at a small enough scale where mind is not happening.
Well,
and you're going, wait a second, there's something like sentience going on,
like
all the way through the
there.
System.
Yeah.
Right, including to where you get to those lower scales where it's really hard to talk about material. When you're talking about wave functions of probability,
like
you
light.
Know, there's no stuff there. But you still are finding the activity of sentience. And with this work, I started to work with a quantum physicist named Manas Kafatos. And he was the one that pointed out to me, we were talking about the sentient stuff, and I said to him, something that's puzzled me for a long time is, what distinguishes a universe that could self-organize, a quantum foam that could self-organize, from a universe that couldn't self-organize? And so we started talking about this, and I said something about, well, I guess the fundamental thing is they have to interact. And he said, well, but isn't that what you're saying sentience is?
Hmm.
Duh.
Well, that's funny, because it is interaction, because the word consciousness actually etymologically comes from consensus, which literally means a bunch of stuff coming together and interacting on a conscious level, making a decision that, yes, this thing is so, right?
And what is interacting? You right. discover that something's there, and you respond to it. That's the nature of interaction. So the universe exists because the universe is sentient. So that's one way in which this way of looking at things comments on the notion of consciousness. Another way, and this comes from Manas very much, and our conversations, at the quantum realm, we know there's the famous double-slit experiment, where if you do an experiment, light turns out to be made of waves, and if you do the experiment differently, it turns out it's made of photons that act like little balls. Is light a wave, or is light made of particles? Well, it turns out that until you look at it, it's a superposition of both wave and particle phenomena. But when you choose a way to observe it, it will always give you one view or the other. These views, as Niels Bohr said, are complementary, but neither is complete. The way the body is neither just cells nor just fluid. Those are two incomplete but complementary models. So the point of view, the stance of observation, determines what properties will be revealed. And so another area that Manas and I have worked in is extending that idea of complementarity up out of the quantum realm, where people have preferred to keep it walled in, and show that it exists in biological systems, it exists at the cosmological level. And so how the conscious mind views the world determines the nature of how the world is present in any given moment. So consciousness makes the world.
Right. Would you separate that from the Heisenberg-like stuff where he was talking about the interaction? Yeah, it's the same thing, right?
It's exactly the same thing. And in fact, that Nature paper of mine, my famous little Nature paper, one of the things it talked about was cellular uncertainty. And I was particularly referring to Heisenberg. But at the time, I thought it was sort of like a similar thing. And now I realize it is precisely the same thing.
It's the same thing, yeah.
It is exactly the same thing.
Well, I think one of the things I really want to just to emphasize, because it is a real shift that this implies, is that even if I think, you know, some people are uncomfortable saying that only human beings have consciousness or only mammals have consciousness, and they recognize that there's probably something like mine going on in all sorts of, you know, higher level creatures.
Uh-huh.
But still, at the back of their minds, they're probably working with the assumption, unless they believe in souls, but I'm going to put that one aside, but just if they're thinking scientifically, that there's some kind of complexity in the system, in the physical matter, and at some point, it boots up something like mind.
Uh-huh.
And the model you're talking about is a switch, where there's always an inside, or there's always something like sentience all the way through, from the top to the bottom, that it is fundamentally part of the universe, not as something that emerges in certain conditions, but it's always running through at varying levels of complexity, of detail, of depth.
And it may be simpler at lower levels of scale.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean it's absent.
Exactly, but
simpler.
That's a huge,
right.
I think that has all sorts of implications, and because we could go on for hours, we only have a few, you know, we're winding down here, and I want to make sure to give you a shot at saying a little bit about how following this path through science, through, you know, philosophical questions, but of science, you have come to certain places that resonate with your own spiritual practice, with your interest in Zen Buddhism, and your practice of Zen Buddhism, and your interest in Kabbalah. And I'm, you know, there's so much to say there already, but I'm actually kind of most interested in what these practices and ideas do for you as a scientist. Here you are as a scientist, you've got your laboratory work, you've got your paper in Nature, you're talking about these philosophical but scientific principles, and then, oh, look, Neil's going to bring in Zen again. Oh, Neil's going to talk about Kabbalah, just what we need. Like, for you, why is it important still to make those connections and even make them part of your work in a public way?
Well, first off, when you do any sort of contemplative training, but certainly Zen Buddhism, one of the points, one of the fundamental aspects of it is that you are not judging and assigning meaning to things as you encounter them when you're meditating. And, you know, Suzuki Roshi, who founded San Francisco Zen Center, called this beginner's mind. He said that in the mind of the expert, there are few possibilities. In the mind of the beginner, there are many. Because as an expert, you're already saying, well, it's not that, it's not that. We know that. We don't have to reconsider that. And at every step of the way, I think it's my Zen training which taught me to go, hold on, do I really know everything that's going on here? So rather than judge my data in terms of my previous ideas, I just let the data be there in front of me. And that's a liver pathology training, too, because the liver doesn't have a lot of ways to respond to injury. And so if the clinician gives me a history, partial history or a wrong history because someone wrote it down wrong or something, I can look at the same slide and I can go, yeah, that's hepatitis C. But if they gave me a different history, it might be a disease called primary biliary cirrhosis. I need to just look at the slide with no history, so I'm not biased, so I see the subtleties. And that's how I do my work. But in terms of this is, I said there were three ways in which consciousness comes into play here, in my view of the world as a complex system. The third is that contemplative practices from all sorts of traditions, whether it's Jewish mysticism, Hindu mysticism, Christian, Sufis, Buddhists, they all make three categories of claims about the meaning and what happens when you practice like that. The first is that you simply are healthier. You stay younger, your tissues are more resistant to disease, they heal better if they're ill, and the fact is there is a vast body of literature, which I've now published some of that myself because it's one of the things I research, but there's a huge amount of data out there that says that's exactly what happens. Meditative practices, saying mantras, yoga asana practice, the movement sort of stuff, pranayama, focusing on your breathing and manipulating your breathing, all impact beneficially on the human organism. They do. It's not a question. The details are still being worked out, but the data is there. That's true. The second class of claims is that you impact on the brain and the mind. Well, you look at work like Richie Davison's lab at University of Wisconsin. Meditating changes your brain. And you can even direct how it changes your brain. You do this meditation, you'll get that kind of change. You do this meditation, you'll get that kind of change. So that's been verified broadly, widely. It's not arguable. The third category of claims is that the mind can perceive the nature of the universe at the most fundamental level. Well, that's trickier. But when you look at the Buddhist system of contemplation, what comes out, things like emptiness of inherent existence, that's whether or not something looks like a thing at one level of scale, but another level of scale is not a thing. That's what's meant by that. Impermanence, complex systems, the mathematics of complex systems means everything will come to an end. There will always be a mass extinction event. That's what impermanence is at every level of scale. You know, on and on, I can map Buddhist metaphysics to complexity theory, no problem. Jewish mysticism, that the world is created in each moment by arising out of the infinite, empty, indescribable. In Judaism, it's the mind of God. In Buddhism, it's the absolute. In Hinduism, it's Brahman. All of those are described as this incredibly fertile, productive, creative, empty field of existence that's beyond description, out of which erupts the creative reality of the world. Well, what does this sound like? This sounds like the quantum foam coming out of the vacuum. And Buddhists would say, what is the quantum foam arising from? Their direct experience of that in contemplation is that that is mind. Jewish mystics would say that is God. Hindus would say that is Brahman. But when you read their descriptions, they're just looking for culturally words from their own culture to describe this incredibly productive, empty, but energetic field
description. I can think of two scientific examples that can prove that the human mind can conceive of the pattern all the way down. The first being the guy that discovered benzene, and these are both particular to the issue. Benzene is a hexagon, right? He had a dream. This was pre-microscope. He discovered benzene structure in a dream. He saw it as a serpent biting its own tail in a rubrus, right? The second example is on the macro. You can look at the planet Saturn, which they discovered has a hexagon on it, and the ancient symbol for Saturn is, of course, a hexagon. So you can see it happening now. There's no question that exists.
Well, and you know, I agree there's no question, but people would argue.
But well, so, it's so to like me, you are drawing these connections that really help help keep the science spirituality conversation rich and resonating. I just want to let people know that they can check out more about your work on your website at Neil Theise.com, and you got links and podcasts. Watch that Vimeo video. It's
and
really
actually
excellent.
Better than that is neilthies.wordpress.com, because that I update.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
There you go. So Neil, thanks so much for being on Expanding Mind.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, from me and Majid Ali out there, keep your minds open.